Well, we're on the final stretch of a Daedalus flight, and I thought it would be a good idea just to get our bearings again and to recall what it is we're doing. Et ignotas animum dimittit in artes. And he turned his mind to unknown arts to leave the bondage of his Irish Catholic environment, the labyrinth, and fly to the mainland. Now, in the portrait, he seemed to think that what was binding him was Ireland. Then he goes to Paris and is recalled, and at the opening of Ulysses, he's back in Dublin with these two chaps, Buck Mulligan and Haynes. And what he realizes here, and this is what the whole sense of that third chapter where he's walking on Sandymount shore, what he realizes here is that the bondage is not of Ireland, but of his egoism. I mean, it's translated now into a psychological trap that he's in. And on that walk along the shore, he is asking himself, would he have the courage to give himself to anybody? Or to any deed, even, that was not self-serving? As I tried to point out in my first discussion of that meditation on the shore, he is engaged in a philosophical and epistemological meditation. Would he give himself up to someone else? What he's going to find is that what he's giving up is his mere secondary character as an independent ego maintaining himself. And what he is moving into is his true being. Now, in working the thing out, he uses those two words of Schopenhauer, the nebeneinander and the nacheinander, the beside each other, space, and the nacheinander, which is time. And then he comes to the problem of causality. Now, this is basic Schopenhauer thinking. Kant, in the Critique of Pure Reason, had in the first section, Transcendental Aesthetic, spoken about our reception of experience, our apprehension of experience, as being enclosed and in and conditioned by time and space. We don't have experiences except in this context. It's as though we had lenses, time-space lenses. And what is the relationship of these phenomenal objects in the field of time and space to true being, the Ding an sich, as Kant called it, or as Joyce calls it in Phineas Wake, the Ding hvad in itself id est. What is this Ding an sich? Well, since all things are enclosed in time and space, this thing in itself, which is transcendent of that, is no thing. That which is no thing. The second part of the Kantian critique has to do with our thinking about the objects that we experience. And all of our thinking is bound by what Kant calls the categories of logic. And these categories include such things as being and not being, one and many. These are all categories of thinking. Now, the word God is supposed to refer past itself to an absolute mystery. God is beyond our knowing and naming, and yet using the word God, we've named it. So God is not God. That's all there is to that. And in Meister Eckhart, we hear, The ultimate and most difficult leave-taking is the leaving of our notion of God for God. And our notion of God is historically conditioned by our culture, as is all of our thinking. And it's this that our friend Stephen realizes he's got to break out of, not only the ego, but also this whole conditioning field. And that is the problem that is summarized in the word that we brought up yesterday, contransmagnificandru bangtantiality. A man has drowned. The drowned man in the sea becomes symbolic of the ding an sich. That is to say, the hidden thing which is drowned in the sea of our phenomenal experiences. So what he is trying to do is ask himself if he can find the drowned man, if he can go to the drowned man. And what finally turns up in the relationship to Leopold Bloom, a man whom he hardly knows, is that I and thou, we are, in terms of the transcendence of time and space, the same. Now, this is an idea that Schopenhauer presents in his paper on the foundation of morality. I am absolutely convinced that Joyce is following Schopenhauer here. And he mentions the name only once or twice in the whole history of this document. In the paper on the foundation of morality, Schopenhauer asks the question that Stephen is asking. Schopenhauer asks, how can one so participate in the peril of another that forgetting his own self-protection, he moves spontaneously to the other's rescue? And this is what Stephen asked himself on the shore. Would I forget myself and move to rescue another? Move to rescue another, not in the way of something that you regarded as your duty. That would be from up here, but in the way of a spontaneous act. And how is it that our first law of nature, namely self-protection and self-defense, is suddenly dissolved and another law take over so that the impulse is from another level? And Schopenhauer's answer is, this is a metaphysical realization, namely, you and that other are one. That's the problem that Stephen is facing here. Now, Schopenhauer has another paper, and this is called Transcendental Meditations or Thoughts on the Apparent Intention in the Destiny or Fate of an Individual. Transcendental Thoughts on an Apparent Intention in the Fate of the Individual. Eine anscheinende Absichtlichkeit im Schicksale des Individuums. He says, you go through life and this accident, that accident, apparently coincidences of one time you meet somebody and so forth, and this, you get this job, you marry this person, and so forth and so on. It all as though they were things that had not been programmed. And then when you get to be about 60 or 70 or something like that, you look back over your life, and by gosh, it has the continuity of a novel. And these things that seem to be so accidental are recognized as being essential elements in a well-constructed plot. There's no doubt about it. And he says, who wrote the novel? Yeah. And then considering this, that everybody whom you recognize as influencing your life has in one way or another been influenced by you and by other people, so that everybody's influencing everybody else in this funny way and all these novels interlock. And he comes to this thought. It is though the whole universe were a dream dreamed by a single dreamer, in which all the dream characters dream too. And so all these dreams interlock. Well, this is an idea that comes up in India in what is known as the net of Indra. The universe is, as it were, a net of gems. It's all called the net of gems, in which in all the junctures of the net, at each of these, there is a jewel. And each of the jewels reflects all the others. That's this idea of we're all particles of this great cycling dream. That's the inspiration of Finnegan's Wake. So we go plunging into the water, giving ourselves to that other, as we'll see Stephen doing it, giving himself to Bloom in a crazy moment in the brothels chapter. And when we have made that plunge, we have become identical with that which is dreaming the world. And so this is the process from what I'm going to be dealing with this morning here, that brothels chapter in Ulysses. We move right from that into Finnegan. Ulysses tells how we get there. And Finnegan's Wake is what we experience when we're there. You see? Now, in Dante, his three great sections of the Divine Comedy, the first is hell, of souls bound in hell. And Dante then, under the guidance of Virgil, walks through hell. That means he's reviewing all the bondages of his own earthly life, those things which bound. But instead of staying stuck in any of the circles, he moves through. That's what we're doing in the first part of Ulysses. And you noticed how sort of just objective and dry and matter-of-fact that passage at the opening was that I read at the conclusion of yesterday, where we're just have a naturalistic attention to details and the wonderful development of this character, Bloom, which comes up throughout through all his adventures. You really get such a picture of a man as nobody has ever rendered in literature before. I mean, every detail of this man's thinking and feeling. But then in Purgatory, we begin to move up a mountain, the Purgatorial Mountain. You know, in the Middle Ages, it was thought that the world was a sphere, but that the southern hemisphere, the lower half of the globe, was all water. No one had ever gone down south of the African bulge there, of West Africa. It was thought it was all water down there. And the idea was also that when Satan was thrown out of heaven, he struck the earth with such force that he plunged right to the middle of the planet and is stuck at the very middle of the planet. So the central core of our earthly life is the devil. He's stuck there. And when he went plunging through, a great chasm was opened. That's the chasm of the pit of hell. But all the earth that had been in that chasm was forced out the other end, so that rising out of the southern water is a mountain, and that's the mountain of purgatory. So we start with this perspective, moving down through hell, and then in the middle, there's a wonderful moment in the Divine Comedy when Dante and Virgil are crawling down the leg of the devil. His genitals are right at the center of the sphere of the universe. They gradually realize they're not going down, they're going up. See, they've gone through the center and they're now climbing. So they come up then, and here then is the great purgatorial mountain. Now, the purgatorial mountain represents stages in being divested of the weight of sin. There are seven sins: pride, covetousness, lust, anger, envy, gluttony, and sloth. And pride is the sin of sins. That means attention to your ego, egoism. This is the sin that our friend Stephen has to get rid of. And as one climbs the mountain, the ascent becomes easier and easier and easier, because you're throwing off one sin bondage after another. And then you come to the earthly paradise. This is what Finnegan's Wake is, the earthly paradise on the summit of the purgatorial mountain. That is where Dante leaves Virgil behind and sees again and meets the Beatrice, who had died in the middle of the Portrait of the Arcisium, of the Vita Nuova. So the second part of Ulysses, after that thunderclap, which is the voice of God, and the compassion, Mitleid is the German, and that's the word that Schopenhauer uses as being the impulse energy that moves us to the rescue of another, to the recognition of ourselves in another. After that, we have a gradual purgation that's taking place, and this thing comes to its culmination in the brothels chapter. Then in Finnegan's Wake, we're in the earthly paradise, where all forms are radiant of the transcendent energy of which we are all manifestations. In ordinary life, we are opaque. The artist must so arrange the forms of time that the radiance becomes experienced. Integritas, consonantia, claritas. And in the earthly paradise, all things are radiant in this way. That's why living in Japan is such a pleasure. Because these are people with very strong aesthetic accent. And everywhere you look, you experience the radiance, or at least I do. And that is really the earthly paradise. I have one friend who said the United States should conquer Japan and turn it into a national monument. The world of art is the earthly paradise. It is the world where the radiance shines through the forms. And then, of course, Beatrice takes the lead and guides Dante from the earthly paradise up through the spheres. And here you leave the material altogether and come to the realm of sheer spirit. And this, of course, was what Joyce was going to give us in the fourth book, which was never written. We have a couple of clues. He said it was going to be short and lucid. You weren't going to have to go fishing around. All the motifs of the earlier works would here come to a radiant simplicity. It's a great loss we don't have this. And what was it going to be about? It was going to be about the ocean, the sea. Now, I think I know what he had in mind. You'll see when we move into the brothels here, there are some references to Hindu images. In fact, they're dominant. And one of the great Hindu images of the world dream is of Vishnu dreaming the universe. We are all parts of Vishnu's dream. See? So I'm almost certain that he was going to give us Vishnu's dream. You see, Vishnu floating on the ocean. Now there's one of the Indian Puranas, one of the Indian Bibles, you might call them, is called the Markandeya Purana. And this is about a sage who just didn't die when the world dissolved. Vishnu is couched on a serpent. The serpent's name is Ananta, unending, floating on the cosmic ocean out of which all energy comes. So you have the oceanic level, you have the animal level of the serpent who forms the couch for Vishnu's dream, and Vishnu is reclining there. Now in the Indian pictures, we see the world dream coming from Vishnu in the form of a lotus growing from his navel. The lotus. Joyce says at one time, lotus spray, in Finnegan's way. The lotus spray. And this unfolds then in history, the history of the unfolding of the lotus. And then at the end of the world, the lotus closes and goes back to Vishnu's body and then comes forth again. So don't be afraid about the atom bomb. It will just annihilate this particular lotus moment. And it goes back and comes out again. So you see there are two aspects now to history. One is the unfolding, when it comes forth and dissolves. And the other is the condition between cycles, when it is potential within the belly of Vishnu. The world, not in its historical unfolding, but in its total potentiality. Do you see what I mean? This is what Joyce was going to write about in the heaven. Now there is a sage, Markandeya, who survived the end of the world and was wandering around inside Vishnu's interior, viewing the scenery of the world, which was going to come, the kind of the Platonic idea of history as a luminous, eternal moment in the belly of the god. And Markandeya had the misfortune, or perhaps you might call it good fortune, to slip out of Vishnu's mouth at one time and to fall out into the cosmic darkness. Well, Vishnu just reached out his hand and put him back in his mouth and so forth. But I think the later book is going to be the simplicity of all of these potentialities. Here we see the potentialities and actualities in the form of the lives of actual concrete human beings. Then in Finnegan's Wake, we move into the dream consciousness level. Finnegan's Wake is a novel written on the level of dream consciousness. The Hindus speak of waking consciousness, the world of gross bodies, have to be illuminated from without, change forms slowly, and where an Aristotelian logic prevails, I am not you, this is not that, A is not A. Then the next mode of consciousness is dream consciousness, where the objects are self-luminous, they shine of themselves, they're of what is called subtle matter, that's what Finnegan's Wake is, subtle matter, and the subject and object are the same. I, as dreamer, am surprised by my dream, yet the dream is I. And so, subject and object, though they seem to be separate, are one. We are now in the realm transcendent of duality. And this is an intermediate realm between the hard fact realm and the transcendent, when all things are one. So the dream realm is the earthly paradise realm, where forms manifest in a mysterious way their identity even through their separateness. So we're going to this morning to move from Ulysses, the journey of gross objects into the realization of Tattvamasi, you and it are one. And then in Finnegan, we move over to that other perspective. And what you'll see is the dreamer is all the objects of his dream. And the principal objects of this dreamer's dream are the members of his family. And the members of his family are his wife and daughter, Molly and Millie, but now seen in the way of dream radiance, and his two sons, one the pen man, and the other the successful political guy and the winner. The pen man, the loser, the other one, the winner. And who are they? Stephen and Buck Mulligan. And but these two become just shadow. They are grotesque caricatures playing over the surface of the dream. And the real basic figure is the father, the dreamer, whose sons are, you might say, concretizations or realizations of a dream that he had when he begot them, and so forth and so on. It's a radical transformation of style, as you'll see, and when we move into the Finnegan. Now with this, I think I should go on explaining something about Finnegan, because it's to this that we're moving through the Ulysses passage. How many in this room were at the lecture I gave on Finnegan's Wake the other evening? Oh, well, then you got most of the story. I'll just review the main lines very concisely. All the dream characters are aspects of the dreamer. And not only the dream characters, but the landscape aspects of the dreamer. And a dreamer, a human dreamer, has two levels to his dream. One is the level having to do with his personal experience, his personal life. But the energies of the dream are those of the human body. And so there is a collective or general aspect to the dream as well as the personal one. Your personal life guidance is gradually extinguished as you go into sleep. And you carry with you a residual recollection of your life. But you're moving into a sphere of permanent energies, the energies of your body. Some of these have not been allowed to play a role in your living. And so you come into relation to them with surprise. There are therefore, you might say, two orders of dream. And using Jung's term, one is the personal and the other the collective. The personal aspect of the dream. Am I going to pass the exam? I can remember the dreams of that sort. Am I going to marry Susie or Betty? You know, these are just personal things. But when you get down a level below that, the imagery is identical with the imagery of myth. This is the collective aspect. As I was saying a couple of days ago, distinguishing between Freud and Jung, Freud emphasizes the biographical aspect of a dream, your biography, what happened to you. So that in a Freudian analysis, you're going back trying to find out what it was that happened to you when the baby carriage rolled off the porch, something like that. Then there is another level to the dream energies, and that is of the biology. And your biology is related to the biology of plants and animals. They too share the life energies. This is what in India is called the Vijnanamaya Kosha, the wisdom body, in contrast to the mental wisdom, mental and body wisdom. The mental wisdom is carried in by the personal experience, the biographical, and the body wisdom then meets it. Now, in Finnegan's Wake, there are two main characters, two main male characters, two main dreamers. One is Finnegan. The story of Finnegan is based on an Irish-American popular song called Finnegan's Wake. Joyce waited until he had actually finished Finnegan's Wake, which took about 18 years, before he let anybody know what the title of his book was going to be. He published in Emile Jolas's journal called Transition, published some of the first versions of it under the title Work in Progress. But then one evening, he instituted a guessing game in a restaurant as to what the title of his book was going to be, and I've forgotten who got it. It said Finnegan's Wake, and the account says that Joyce seemed completely deflated after that and got out. Well, anyhow, Finnegan, to state it very briefly, is a hod carrier. Now, in the old days, before we had these elevators that took all the material up the side of a building that's under construction, the bricks for building the walls and so forth were carried by Irishmen with hods. That was just at the time, you know, the beginning of the century, when the Irish immigrants were most of the workers here. And there were signs all over Boston, no Irish need apply. They were the denigrated group. So here we have all these Irishmen with hods carrying bricks up ladders from one level to another. And then after they dump the bricks, they come down another set of ladders without any bricks in the hods, but just air. So they're carrying matter up and spiritus, air, down. And they're circulating matter and spirit. And it's kind of a ever-circling chain. Well, Finnegan is one of these chaps, and he's climbing the ladder. Now, like many of his race, he likes whiskey. The word whiskey, translated into English, means water of life. And the whiskey that he's particularly fond of is Jameson's whiskey, which is an Irish whiskey made in Dublin from the water of the River Liffey. Well, the River Liffey happens to be the heroine of Finnegan's Wake. And so here's the river, little mother river, Anna Livia, Anna Liffey, Plurabelle, variously beautiful. And the extract, that's to say the real juice and magic of the river, is in whiskey. So he is drunk one day and falls from the ladder, falls down. And his friends think he's dead and carry him home, and we have the wake. During the wake, everybody's dancing. It's a real Irish wake. Everyone's having a lot of fun. And lots of fun at Finnegan's Wake is the refrain. Somebody spills some whiskey over Finnegan, and he gets up and dances at his own wake. That's the Finnegan's Wake. And you get the story of death and resurrection and trance throwing off the shackles of death and so forth and so on. But in Finnegan, when Finnegan begins to move, to get up after the whiskey's been spilled over him, they hold him down. They say, no, no, you just stay where you are. Now be easy, good Mr. Finnemore, sir, and take your leisure like a god on pension, and don't be walking abroad. Sure, you'd only lose yourself in Heliopolis now, the way your roads in Kapilavasta are that winding there after the Calvary. And you'd wet your feet, maybe, with the foggy dew, meeting some sick old bankrupt, or the Carteret's donkey with his shoe hanging clankata-chankata, or a slut snoring with an impure infant on a bench. It would turn you against life. Stay down there. Let the wake go on. Let's have fun, and you stay where you are. Now, the idea is that this fall is Adam's fall. And it's on Adam's fall that all of time depends. I mean, we'd be Adam and Eve stuck in paradise forever. Yeah, the earthly paradise, all right, but what about time? And as soon as you get time, you have death and birth, birth and death, the whole agony and the sorrows of the world. But this is all depending on Adam's fall. So our life is Adam's wake. Do you get the idea? But now when you look at the title of the book, Finnegan's Wake, there's no apostrophe there. It's not Finnegan's Wake at all. This is a simple declarative sentence. Finnegan's Wake. And you know what the Buddha, the word the Buddha means? The one who woke up. He woke up to that which he truly was, namely immortal consciousness. And Finnegan's, even though they are involved, even though we are involved in the field of time and Maya, delusion, thinking that this is it, we wake. But by gosh, if Adam wakes, that's the end of the show, isn't it? So let's hope he stays down and let's enjoy the fun of plurality. Realizing that we're all one. This is the condition of the bodhisattva, the one whose being is illumination and yet joyously participates in the sorrows of the world. That's Finnegan's Wake. I mean, this is a fantastic thing he's done with this. But then the other thing, of course, is Finn again. You know the little sigh. There was a man named Michael Finnegan. He had whiskers on his chin again. The wind came along and blew them in again. Poor old Michael Finnegan. Begin again. There was a man named Michael Finnegan. The great hero here is Finn McCool, the great pre-medieval pagan guardian of Dublin, who was a giant. And so it's as though the whole history of Dublin, which is the history of the world, were the dream of Finn. He's the dreamer. This is an echo of Blake, Albion's dream, the dream of Albion, which is Britain. This is Ireland's Albion, you might say. As I said in my talk the other evening, all through the time of the Watergate trial, I had the strange feeling that I've read all this before. And when Agnew said, "This is a nightmare," I got it. It's Finnegan's Wake. The Finnegan's Wake is the dream, the nightmare of a tavern keeper living just in a lovely little suburb just on the edge of Dublin called Chapel Isod. And that means the place where Isolde was born and lived. And Chapel Isod is right on the edge of Phoenix Park, which is the public park in Dublin. And the phoenix is the bird that burns itself to death and comes to life again. Somebody once said everything around Dublin was made for Joyce. The words can be just given a little twist and you get the same old story. So Finnegan born again and they are alive again and the Phoenix alive again and Phoenix Park as though it were the Garden of Eden where man fell but life began all add up. Now there's a word that comes I think originally from Augustine. O felix culpa, O happy fault, O happy sin of Adam that brought to us the Savior. There would have been no coming of Christ if there had not been the sin. O felix culpa. And Joyce speaks of, O Phoenix culprit. This is the mystery. And then finally, just to give the clue of where we're going, and this is the reason I'm dealing with this now before the Ulysses, is to point out the destination of our trip. This is where we're going to as we go through the brothel thing here. There's a number that occurs throughout the book, and it's 1132. It occurs as a date, it occurs as a patent number, it occurs as 32 West 11th Street, number of a street, number of people in a room, and so forth and so on. And when I was working on the skeleton key to Finnegan's Wake, I tried to interpret this number. As Bloom wanders through Dublin, he thinks occasionally 32 feet per sec, the law of falling bodies. And so it's the number of the fall, the 32. And 11 is the renewal of the decade. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 9, 10, and then 11. We start another decade, starting around again. Stephen is 22 years old, twice 11. Bloom's little son, Rudy, died when he was 11 days old, 11 years ago. So Stephen is, as it were, the return. And so I thought, well, that's 1132, the return and the fall. And then one day I'm reading, preparing a class in early Christianity, reading St. Paul, Epistle to the Romans, and I come across a sentence that seems to me to catch the total sense of Finnegan's Wake, the, you might say, the motto of Finnegan's Wake in Paul. For God has consigned all men to disobedience. He's made us naughty, that he may show his mercy to all. And falling into sin, you invoke God's mercy. And the deeper into sin, the bigger the job for God. So as Luther says somewhere, sin boldly. And that's what you have here. But what this implies also is no judgment. You don't judge the sinner. And Jesus says, judge not that you may not be judged. And Jesus says that so that as the rain of your Father in heaven falls on the just and the unjust, so also your mercy. So this is the challenge. And one of the marvelous things about Finnegan's Wake is the depth of depravity that he can represent here with compassion, brutality, and everything. And of course, the real love thy neighbor as thyself, which is what this is all about, and love thy enemy as thyself. The culminating problem for a true Irishman would be the phenomenon of a British person. Haynes in Ulysses here, I think it's Mulligan who says at one time, horn of a bull, heel of a horse, smile of a Saxon. The hero of Finnegan's Wake, whose initials are HCE, is English. And he is identified at times in this mythological way with Cromwell. Now, Cromwell makes Hitler look like an amateur. And I can remember when Hitler came into control in Germany, there were three biographies of Cromwell that were written. He extinguished the population in the north of Ireland and moved a lot of Scottish Protestants, Presbyterians, in. This was known as the Plantation. And it was at that time that the Irish, who could escape the Holocaust, took flight to Spain and the Spanish colonies. And that's why you find so many Irish names in South America. This was a wipeout. And Cromwell, and then earlier than that, Henry II conquering Ireland. All these invaders and brutalizers of Ireland are summed up in the dreamer. Well, this dreamer, the owner of the tavern, is running for political office. And there is a rumor out that he committed some kind of indiscretion in Phoenix Park in association with two young women. These are the temptresses. It was at night, and three drunken soldiers were witnesses in the dark. As they say, eye, ear, nose, and throat witnesses. The rumor gets out as to what went on, and nobody knows what went on. You're beginning to get the sense of the Watergate here? Then there are newspaper reporters going all over town taking notes on what do you think happened and what do you think of the man and what about his character, and you get pages and pages of this. And there are four old sleepy chroniclers. Now all of these become beginning to have mythological associations. The four chroniclers are the four points of the compass. They're also the four waves of Ireland, the four actual chroniclers. They're also the four Zoas of Blake's Dream of Albion. But I thought of them as these instant analysts that appear on the radio and television, Savaride and that bunch. Immediately knowing everything and yet really knowing nothing any more than you do. So there are these four. There's a jury of 12 upright citizens that are reviewing all the evidence. And the principal bit of evidence that is finally turned up is a letter that was dug out of a manure pile by a hen whose name is Belinda. And the letter, it's difficult to date because it was soiled by tea where the date was. And wherever a word occurs that would really tell you who or what it was, the hen's beak has gone through the manuscript. So we have the tapes. And the principal threatening person that really overthrows HCE in his dream is a reflection of himself. So why was it that I felt deja vu when I was reading Watergate? It was fantastic. But the interesting thing, you see, is that the scoundrel's name here, Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker, when you put the initials down only, you get HCE, which translates into Here Comes Everybody. And here you get Hawthorne's word, you might say, as your clue. We cannot deny our brotherhood, even with the guiltiest. You know. So this is our own story in a very amusing way and a very instructive way. So we have two dreamers here. We have the man in the tavern, beset by this anxiety about his public reputation, filled with newspaper reports and the chatter that's been going on in his own tavern that night. He was serving these people and they were reciting the stories right in front of his face, you know, and eat him out of house and home, the wake. And then he goes up to bed with his wife, And this dream overwhelms him. And the dream involves himself and his wife, the old maid servant in the house, the two missies in the park, the three so-called witnesses, his children, the two boys and his daughter, And then his own almost incestuous love for the daughter, who is the little girl that his wife was years and years ago. And this business of each is the other, it all begins to go together in his dream. It's a fantastic affair. And it all then is resting on the energies of the biological ground, of which this personal history is but one inflection, and the dreamer of that dream is the Finnegan underneath. That's the setup here. Well, with that little introduction, I think it'd be good to have just a moment break, because I'm now going to go to Ulysses, and I'd like to change the atmosphere.
Locked in.